From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, what's so funny about love and sex in the age of AIDS? We talk with playwright Paul Rudnick about his off-Broadway comedy, Jeffrey, about a man who swears off love and sex and then meets the man of his dreams. Also, a book of poems inspired by the AIDS epidemic. Maureen Corrigan reviews The Man with Night Sweats by Tom Gunn. And musical Americana, interpreted by guitarist Bill Frisell. He'll tell us why he's recorded works by Copeland, Ives, Dylan, Sousa, Rollins, and Madonna, and performed them with an unconventional ensemble featuring accordion, clarinet, drums, and, of course, guitar. That and more are coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Today, President Clinton formally presented his $1.5 trillion budget for 1994 to Congress. The thick document sticks fairly close to the plan that the president outlined in February. The biggest change is that the amount of deficit reduction, $447 billion in 5 years, was lower than the president originally proposed. The budget calls for government spending to remain essentially the same as this year, with an increase of about 3.2% for inflation. Senate Republican leader Bob Dole reacted quickly to the Clinton administration budget, saying the plan contained more taxes and spending. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Dole said he believes that as more Americans become aware of what's in the president's budget, the less they'll like it.
I think there's a concern, and it's directed at us too, don't misunderstand me, not just the president, that we're back on the same old track again of spending money, too much for Congress, too much for the executive. We're not cutting spending. We're asking them to pay more taxes, and they don't like it.
Dole said he thinks the budget will be a hard sell. The minority leader, who has led the Republican battle against the president's stimulus proposal, also said he wasn't ready to offer a compromise package. Dole said he wants to avoid the situation in which he offers an alternative program, and then the Democrats will try to meet him halfway. Dole called that a trap and said he's waiting to hear from the Democrats first. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
In Bosnia, Serbian soldiers found thousands of rounds of ammunition concealed in a United Nations aid truck today. And the troops discovered the ammunition in a routine search at a checkpoint. The aid truck was traveling from Sarajevo Airport to a village held by the Bosnian government. The BBC's Alan Little reports from Sarajevo.
The discovery was made in the Serb-held suburb of Ilija while UNHCR officials were present. 48 boxes of heavy machine gun and rifle rounds were wedged beneath pallets carrying food aid. The truck had been loaded at Sarajevo Airport, which is controlled by the United Nations, and was part of a convoy carrying flour to the Bosnian government-held village of Butmir nearby. A spokesman here said UNHCR officials expressed their absolute surprise at the discovery and that the Serbs had responded with fury. UN officers then searched the airport. A further consignment was discovered, including machine gun cartridges, sniper bullets, and some explosives. This is bound to prompt a review of UNPROFOR security arrangements, and it will provoke a furious row between the United Nations force here and the Serbs, who have long suspected UNPROFOR aid convoys of transporting weapons.
The BBC's Alan Little in Sarajevo. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost half a point to close at 3,396.48. Advances edged declines in heavy trading. This is NPR News. United Nations relief workers transported 2,100 Muslim civilians out of the besieged town of Srebrenica today. And the refugees were taken out in a truck convoy that brought food and medicine to the town. Two other evacuation attempts were blocked this week when Muslim officials said they feared that the operation would weaken the town's defenses. More than 1 million people in the Milwaukee area are stocking up on bottled water today after being warned that a flu-like illness may be coming from their tap water. Beth Graham of member station WUWM in Milwaukee reports.
Federal, state, and local health officials are still trying to track the source of an outbreak of gastrointestinal illness that has struck hundreds of area residents. They say that the recent widespread outbreak of fever, cramps, and diarrhea, which has closed some schools and businesses, is probably due to the parasite Cryptosporidium. The organism is most often found in farm animals and is primarily waterborne. With Wisconsin's recent snowmelt and spring rainfall, health experts are speculating farmland runoff could have contaminated Lake Michigan, Milwaukee's drinking water source. Area residents have been warned to boil any tap water they use until health experts are certain the water is clean enough to drink again. Until that is determined, homes, businesses, hospitals, and schools are wiping out stocks of bottled water as soon as stores get them on the shelves. For National Public Radio, I'm Beth Graham in Milwaukee.
Two Miami men have been arrested and charged in the murder of a German tourist who was beaten and run over by a car as her mother and children watched. Authorities thanked witnesses for helping them identify two men who allegedly attacked and robbed Barbara Mueller Jensen. Police said the two men, who are 18 and 23 years old, were already in custody on unrelated robbery charges. Violence in South Florida has prompted Germany and Great Britain to issue travel advisories this week. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The play Jeffrey is the only play I can think of that opens with a condom breaking. Jeffrey is a comedy about love and sex in the age of AIDS. New York Times theater critic Frank Rich described it as the funniest play of this season and maybe last season, too. My guest is the playwright, Paul Rudnick. He also wrote the hit Broadway comedy I Hate Hamlet. He wrote the screenplay for The Addams Family and its forthcoming sequel. And he wrote the screenplay that many adaptations later became Sister Act. He asked that his name be removed from the film for reasons he'll explain to us later. Rudnick is also the author of the comic novel I'll Take It, about a family of compulsive shoppers. Of course, it's easier to find humor in a shopping spree than in the AIDS epidemic. Rudnick thinks of humor as a weapon against AIDS.
When people come see the play, they're sort of not quite sure what to expect, especially when they hear that it's a comedy about AIDS. They all wonder, how is that possible? And throughout the play, there's sort of a roller coaster effect, because the play doesn't shy away from the subject matter, from AIDS and from that particular nightmare. And there are these moments when the audience will gasp or suddenly become very, very quiet, and they'll feel, oh my God, it's not a comedy anymore. You know, we won't be allowed to laugh after this. And then 5 seconds later, they're howling. And that's just, it's such a thrill for me as a writer and as a person to see that that works and that it's possible.
You know the saying that when you go to bed with someone, you're going to bed with everybody that person has ever slept with. You do that in a pretty comic way in the opening of your play. Would you describe it?
Oh, yes. Well, what I wanted the opening to be, it opens with two men in bed and they're having sex. And then one by one, the rest of the cast pop out of the bed. And suddenly you have eight people. And I based it on the idea of a clown car at the circus, where suddenly, you know, it seems like a tiny little vehicle and suddenly the stage is packed. And the audience, you could see at the beginning, they get a little nervous because they worry when you open a play with two people having sex, sort of, where do you go from there? What are we in for? And then as everyone starts appearing, they start to laugh and they start to just realize, okay, we're not sure what we're in for, but it seems like a good time. I love that kind of opening because it just really, it's the exact right image for the play, the kind of lunacy of sex, period, and certainly of sex nowadays.
You know, in talking about allowing yourself to see a comic side to the epidemic, it reminds me of an op-ed piece you wrote in the New York Times about visiting a friend in the hospital. And your friend had AIDS, and you say that he wasn't a suitably noble dying person. He wasn't only dying, he was whining. And he wouldn't even wear his new silk robe because it was too George Hamilton. How did this experience change you?
Oh, well, that was when this guy who he was dying, and he was horribly obnoxious, which I feel terrible saying that, but someone who's sick and is no longer with us. But all of his friends and myself, we kept visiting and we're really trying to be supportive. And he was treating us the way a rude celebrity would treat a waiter. And even though you don't want to ever desert someone at a point like that, we finally all met in the lobby of St. Vincent's Hospital in front of a bad oil painting of the Pope and collapsed in laughter because that was all that was left. It was just, if we were going to go back up there and be handmaidens to the dying emperor, there was very little choice other than to find it amusing. And it's funny, I have a friend right now, actually, who is quite ill, although on the mend in Florida, and I've been talking to him on the phone, and it reminded me of that situation, except he actually is quite a spectacularly humorous person, and he had just been through a terrible episode of illness, of a viral thing attacking his spine, all sorts of dreadful things. But meanwhile, and his speech was a little slurred. But while I was talking to him, he said, with a little slur, he said, "I know I sound like post-stroke Betty Davis." And then he said, "I hate this hospital. Everywhere I turn, there are crazed candy stripers and Shanghai shame girls." And I wasn't even quite sure what he was talking about, but he seemed in a good mood, and it was his personality coming through the disease. And somehow that seemed a triumph of sorts, and that's what Jeffrey's all about, too, is that kind of victory through personality and humor.
You know, Jeffrey, your main character, says at one point, "I hate sex, I hate love, I hate the world for giving me everything and then taking it back." Have you watched people go through different phases in their attitude about sex and love during the epidemic?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it was why when I first had the idea for the play, the situation of someone giving up sex because of AIDS and because of the last 10 years seemed the romantic situation of our time. And that if you were going to write a play that is in many ways a romantic comedy, that was the dilemma that everyone is in right now. And at that point in the play, Jeffrey, the leading character, has made this vow to give up sex and then met the man of his dreams, this fantastic guy who is also HIV positive. So suddenly I can't imagine being more torn between feelings of overwhelming romantic love and what are you letting yourself in for in terms of someone being sick, in terms of someone who you may then need to be taking quite a bit of care of, and just the idea of falling in love with someone who may very well not live forever. And that's the moment that Jeffrey reaches sort of towards the end of the first act, when he just throws up his hands and says, "These are all the things I love, and they are suddenly seem forbidden. And where's the nearest bridge?" And I think the play is about avoiding the nearest bridge.
Now, we were talking about funerals before. Have you spoken at many funerals?
Let me think. I've spoken sort of as one of a group of friends.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been the main act. I've never been the floor show. Also, because in New York, especially in the theatrical community where they have memorials on the stage of Broadway theaters, it's like, I'm not going to compete with Jennifer Holliday and Patti LuPone. You know, when you've got name entertainment, I think, no, I mean, I'd have to bring out white tigers or something in order to compete. So it's that's what gets also funny, is you start to feel, oh, I don't know, like tickets will be available half price at the booth sometimes for these these events. But I have spoken at them, and it's, I guess, the nicest ones and the most memorable memorials are the most personal. There was one, actually, it was funny. It wasn't for a man who died of AIDS. It was for a man who died of cancer, which, it's funny, there used to be a scene in the play that it's really pushes the boundaries of taste, but everyone I know identified with it, which was when you hear about someone who didn't die of AIDS, when they have a heart attack or brain tumor, you somehow oddly think, good for them. You think, what a horrible response, because they're still dead. But on the other hand, it seems oddly refreshing. I remember when Andy Warhol died and people realized it wasn't AIDS, there was this feeling of that was how original. And I think it's just because death has become so much more commonplace than anyone expected, especially at people at younger ages, that suddenly you're forced into these sort of bizarre responses.
Paul Rudnick is my guest. His comedy, Jeffrey, is playing off-Broadway. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Writer Paul Rudnick is my guest. In your previous play, I Hate Hamlet, which is about a TV actor who's about to play Hamlet, and the actor is met by the ghost of John Barrymore, who, of course, informs him how to perform. So in the part of the ghost of John Barrymore was Nicole Williamson.
God love him.
Well, tell us what happened the night that his co-star, Evan Handler, the actor who played the TV actor in your show, the night that Evan Handler walked out in the middle of the performance.
Yes. Well, no, Evan, it must be said, was a saint. Evan had, this was all tip of the iceberg time. Evan, during rehearsals, had put up with an enormous amount of dreadful misbehavior on the part of Nicole Williamson, and this was the night it finally peaked. And the first act of that play ended with a climactic stage duel with swords. And Nicole Williamson, who is a, oh, egomaniac is far too kind a word. I think you would have to, any word that ends in maniac will do for Nicole. But he began to direct Evan while on stage, and this all sort of culminated in Nicole actually stabbing him and drawing blood. And Evan quite wisely left the stage at that point and the production and the theater. So it was the understudy finished the second act and the rest of the run of the play. And the next morning when I came downstairs to get a magazine at my newsstand, there was a picture from the play that filled the entire front page of the New York Post with the headline, "Star Swats Actor on the Butt." And that kind of phraseology, I think, may explain the troubles that the Post is having right now. But it was a story that then the media just adored. And for weeks thereafter, there were TV crews at the theater. I was getting calls from all over the world. I sort of learned to say no comment in every language. And it seemed to be somehow you could either hear Barrymore up in heaven, you know, cackling gleefully or snickering with vengeance. But it was a very wild time.
Were you in the theater that night?
No, I wasn't. And I'm grateful I wasn't. Many people were there. Even now people come up to me saying I was there as if it were Woodstock. And Gregory Peck was there that night, and Elaine Stritch. I was seeing something else. I ran into the show's press agent later that night who told me that the story was going to appear on the front page of the Times, but that Jerzy Kosinski, the Polish author, had committed suicide that night and had bumped I Hate Hamlet back to the art section. And even though I did not wish Jerzy Kosinski any ill, I began just laughing uncontrollably, and I was so glad he picked that night because I thought, no, I didn't need this on the front page. But so it just had all these sort of absurd dimensions to it.
Isn't it good publicity, though, to have something really wild happen on stage?
It certainly was a lot of publicity. And I think because the play was a comedy and involved a wild figure like Barrymore, it didn't really hurt the play. It sort of fed into it. On the other hand, I felt after that evening, audiences came with real bloodlust, kind of the Roman Colosseum feeling, and were terribly disappointed when no one was stabbed. And I thought, you know, I'm sorry we'd run out of actors. So it had sort of a double-edged sword.
Very funny.
At times.
So Evan Handler was actually stabbed, not just swatted?
Well, swatted enough to draw blood.
Okay.
And cause bruises. Okay. And equity hearings.
Now, I know that you wrote the original version of the movie that became Sister Act. And then you eventually had your name taken off of it. And I think a lot of script doctors rewrote it. What was the difference between your conception and the movie?
Well, the original script, which I was quite fond of, was written very much as a vehicle for Bette Midler,
mm-hmm.
and to take advantage of her genius. And I wanted it to be quite subversive. It had the same overall plot, which was that of a kind of broken down chorus girl who, for various reasons, is forced to join a convent for a brief period of time. But I think kind of the best way to put it is what was intended to be a satire of the singing nun became the singing nun. I wanted to show the triumph of a certain kind of pure show business glee over the Catholic Church, or at least the more repressive aspects of the Catholic Church, because although there are certainly positive, if not miraculous, aspects to most religions, there are also a darker side. And I wanted to show kind of Bette Midler gleefully victorious. And as the rewrites continued, and then when Bette was replaced in the role with Whoopi Goldberg, there were just demands made that I was in violent disagreement with. The movie became much more a case of sort of wholesome uplift and also just not funny, so that I eventually had no choice but to leave the project. And then I left about 2 months before filming began, and it was rewritten by at least five other people, so that the result was very far from my intention. The movie was very successful anyway, so what do I know? But it just was odd.
When you started writing, were there many out writers, you know, gays who were out, like yourself?
Yes. I think, you know, increasingly, certainly more and more that there are. The other night I did a wonderful benefit reading for ACT UP, at which there were practically more gay novelists reading than there were people in attendance, and there was a big crowd. But it's been wonderful. I think one of the great pluses of having so many gay writers is that no one writer has to carry that burden of representing all gay people forever.
Well, what about the differences between being out in Hollywood and on Broadway?
Well, I think in the theater, I mean, both sectors certainly have an enormous amount of gay people working in them. The theater has certainly been far more in the vanguard of gay subject matter, you know, both in AIDS plays in terms of The Normal Heart and As Is and terrific works like that. But just even in terms of real commercial theater, a wonderful show like Falsettos, which, you know, very much has many, many gay characters and is a smash hit on Broadway and is a musical, that just Broadway and wonderfully, I think, the theater audience has been so much more accepting, in fact, eager to hear all sorts of stories. And I think in Hollywood, there's a real fear of gay subject matter and a fear that it's not commercial, a fear that it's off-putting, which I think as time goes by will, God willing, be completely erased, because I think it just leads to so many awful decisions that every gay movie somehow then has to be very serious and it just has to be an ultimate statement. And you think, of course, there's going to often end up being quite boring films because you sense all of this, you know, earnest hand-wringing going on behind them. So I think Hollywood just, you know, has to get over itself. And as it has with black films, films about women, films about all the groups that weren't considered commercial until suddenly you had a smash hit. But Hollywood lives in fear in general. You know, Hollywood is run not just on racism and homophobia, but on fear of studio executives losing their job if they produce the wrong Police Academy 8. So to try and get them to, you know, open up to in terms of subject matter is not easy.
I want to go back to the subject of AIDS for a second, which is the backdrop of your play, Jeffrey. I know a lot of people can't talk about AIDS or their fear of AIDS or their friends who have AIDS. They can't talk about it to their parents because their parents wouldn't understand. Now, I know that your late father had written a textbook about AIDS.
Yes, he had edited one of the first books on the subject at all. It was a compilation of a group of medical articles dealing with AIDS very early on.
So did that make it easy to kind of share your anxieties about your friends and, you know, who were sick with him?
Well, my parents had many gay friends and children of their friends who were sick and dying. And so they experienced it right along with me. I think very much at exactly the same time. My mother also works in the arts and for years worked for the Pennsylvania Ballet. So she was aware of it as soon as anyone else. And something else that was just meant an overwhelming amount to me was my dad actually died last summer of lung cancer, and he didn't live to see Jeffrey produced. And once I became aware that that would probably be the case, I gave him an early draft of the play to read, and which he loved. And being able to share that with him, especially at that point, I was so grateful for that opportunity and grateful for his response. And I feel lucky and privileged beyond belief to have the family that I have, because I know many people grow up in desperately homophobic situations, and people who have AIDS or are simply gay who are rejected, if not violently abused, by their families. And mine could not have been more the reverse. I mean, my family is not, I hate just using words like accepting, because that implies that you make a decision or that, oh, aren't they doing a good deed, because it's so far beyond that. There's, you know, they take an enormous pleasure in my life and in my friends and in their own gay friends, and it's just considered completely normal. And, I can't imagine a better situation.
Did your parents end up almost becoming surrogate parents for friends of yours?
Yes, well, my parents are quite terrific in general, so they're surrogate parents. Well, I don't know if they might be offended if we said surrogate parents. That somehow makes it sound like they're counselors at summer camp, I think. But they are, I certainly think, are cherished friends by people from every walk and gender preference group and race. I think one of the most important things they've taught me is curiosity. It's certainly curiosity, not just as altruism and good deeds, but as a defense against boredom, that the more people you know and the more different people you know, the better time you're likely to have, and that you sort of plan your life as if it were a dinner party with one or more of each group, that it's that's the way everybody has a blast.
Paul, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Paul Rudnick's comedy, Jeffrey, is at the Minetta Lane Theater in New York. The British poet Tom Gunn has always covered a lot of ground in his work, but in 1992 he published a book of poems about one subject, losing friends to the AIDS epidemic. The Man with Night Sweats has just come out in paperback, and Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Tom Gunn is in the generation of poets that includes Allen Ginsberg, Robert Bly, and Audrian Rich. But unlike them, Gunn never lets go in his poetry. He never gets carried away under the influence of sex, myth, or politics with the heady power of his own words. Critics sometimes say that he's too aloof, that all his years of living in San Francisco haven't changed his essential uptight Englishness. In general, I'd agree. Before this year, the last book of Gunn's poems that I bought was in 1976. I was in college, an earnest English major, but tired of studying old cranks like T.S. Eliot. I bought Gunn's book, Moley and My Sad Captains, because it featured drug-induced poems with hip titles like Listening to the Jefferson Airplane. But when I sat down and read them, I was disappointed with their dry tone. I'm not so sure about President Bill, but I'm absolutely convinced that Tom Gunn never inhaled. It may be a ghoulish thing to say, but Gunn's restrained way of writing has finally found its appropriate subject in the AIDS epidemic. Gunn's new poetry collection, The Man with Night Sweats, bears witness over and over again to the death of close friends, a student, even the man who owned the neighborhood gym. Gunn is the ideal guide for this tour through the city of the dead. He's someone who can move you by his precise description of the unpadded shape of a cheekbone, all the while keeping his own tears in check so they don't drown out his steely, poetic voice. In Lament, a long poem about a friend's drawn-out death in a hospital, Gunn even summons up some humor. He reminds his friend of the time when you had your nurse confused, who, seeing you reconciled after 4 years with your gray father, both of you in tears, asked if this was at last your special friend, the one you waited for until the end. The vivid poem, The J-Car, describes the trolley route Gunn rode when he'd visit a friend who'd lost most of his sight and appetite to AIDS. The only kind of food that remotely tempted him was German food. And so Gunn tells us how he'd take this friend to a restaurant where they'd pick at sauerbraten and sit like fearful children, who think if they behave, everything might, still against likelihood, come out all right. The title poem, The Man with Night Sweats, is the only one where Gunn abandons the narrative distance of health and enters into the body of a man with full-blown AIDS. Describing what it's like to wake up wet and shaking, he ends the poem with an image of the kind of dead-of-night despair that almost everybody, at some low point in their lives, has known. I have to change the bed, but catch myself instead, hugging my body to me, as if hands were enough to hold an avalanche off. You'd have to be even stronger than that to withstand the empathetic force of these poems, but then why would you want to?
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Man with Night Sweats by Tom Gunn. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Why is avant-garde guitarist Bill Frisell performing the music of Aaron Copland, Bob Dylan, John Philip Sousa, and Madonna? And what's an accordion doing in his ensemble? Coming up, we talk with Frisell about his new album of Americana. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews a new HBO movie about the Texas mom who plotted to kill her daughter's classmate to ensure her daughter a spot on the cheerleading squad. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. President Clinton today released a $1.5 trillion budget for next year. It includes about $46 billion in new taxes, $9 billion in new spending, and about $20 billion worth of spending cuts. The tax proposals include higher taxes on corporations and the rich, a broad energy tax, and increasing Social Security taxes for wealthy recipients. The new spending is in transportation, education, environmental cleanup, and technology programs. More than half the budget reductions come from the Defense Department, although the plan doesn't cut major weapons systems. In his budget, President Clinton has asked Congress for almost $1 billion more for aid spending. NPR's Chitra Raghavan has the details.
The proposed increase would raise the federal spending on AIDS from $4.5 billion to $5.3 billion. The biggest increase, $425 million, will pay for Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security expenses for the growing numbers of AIDS patients. The National Institutes of Health will get an additional $227 million for AIDS research. And an extra $110 million will go towards the Ryan White Care Act. That gives money to cities hardest hit by AIDS and pays for treatment and home care for people who have no health coverage. The president wants $45 million more for the government's AIDS prevention efforts. That money, too, would go to cities and states for local AIDS education efforts. In Washington, this is Chitra Raghavan.
Judith Kaye, the chief judge of New York State, has pulled herself out of the running for a spot on the U.S. Supreme Court. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Just one day after New York Governor Mario Cuomo formally withdrew his name from consideration, Judge Kaye did the same thing, citing her new responsibilities as New York's top judge. Sworn in last month as chief judge, Kaye said today, quote, "I want to make absolutely clear that I regard my new role not only as a commitment and responsibility, but also as a magnificent opportunity." Kaye had been considered a top contender for the U.S. Supreme Court seat, and Cuomo, the man who named and promoted her on the New York court, singled her out for endorsement in his letter of withdrawal yesterday. White House aides were frankly puzzled by Kaye's withdrawal, but said the president's selection process is proceeding. Among those said to be under consideration are a number of lower court federal judges, among them Patricia Wald in Washington, Stephanie Seymour in Oklahoma, Mary Schroeder in California, Amalia Kearse in New York, Richard Arnold in Arkansas, Stephen Breyer in Massachusetts, and Jose Cabranes in Connecticut. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Artists across the country are mourning the death of singer Marian Anderson. Anderson died today at age 96. She was the first black performer to sing a major role at New York's Metropolitan Opera. In 1939, she electrified a crowd at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed mixed today. This is NPR. Secretary of State Warren Christopher says Iran is buying medium-range missiles from North Korea. Christopher says the Clinton administration is greatly concerned and is monitoring the situation. A new Pentagon report says Syria and China are also developing long-range missiles. A South African official says about 210 people died in police custody last year and 153 the year before. The country's law and order minister gave the numbers to Parliament today. He offered no details of the deaths. One private expert says many of the bodies showed signs of beating or torture. Police call his report exaggerated. The United States will send 24 fighter planes to help enforce the no-fly zone over Bosnia. NPR's John Greenberg has more.
The operation will be controlled by NATO. Pentagon officials predict that as many as 70 planes from various countries will participate. Beginning Monday, 12 Air Force F-15s will be placed under NATO command, and 12 Navy FA-18 fighter bombers will be directed by NATO controllers during patrol missions. The U.S. will also provide 5 refueling aircraft. France is sending 14 warplanes and the Netherlands 8. The United Nations voted last week to enforce the ban on flights over Bosnia. Most of the violations of the no-fly zone have been by helicopters. U.S. military leaders have said that enforcing the ban will have little effect because Serbian planes play a minor role in attacks on Bosnian Muslims. President Clinton discussed the situation in Bosnia today with his top military advisors. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
Serb fighters in Bosnia today found ammunition hidden in United Nations trucks, delivering flour to Muslims outside Sarajevo. The Serbs have often claimed that UN convoys were smuggling arms and ammunition to the Bosnian Muslim government, and the UN has denied the charges. UN officials said they were surprised and promised to investigate. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Bill Frisell has been called a genius of the guitar by composer John Zorn. Many musicians and listeners agree. Frisell studied with one of the most subtle guitarists in jazz, Jim Hall. But Frisell's own playing ranges from subtle lyricism to raucous, noisy distortion. His new album is called Have a Little Faith, but I think of it as Bill Frisell's Americana. It features a wide range of American composers and songwriters he loves, including Aaron Copland, Charles Ives, Muddy Waters, Bob Dylan, Sonny Rollins, and Madonna. Frisell has put together a wonderful but unconventional grouping of musicians to interpret the music. Don Byron is on clarinet, Guy Klusevic on accordion, Kermit Driscoll on bass, Joey Barron on drums. This is their interpretation of Street Scene in a Frontier Town from Copland's Billy the Kid. Music from Bill Frisell's new album, Have a Little Faith. He also does a version of John Philip Sousa's Washington Post March, a staple of marching bands. I asked him why he chose the march.
That was one of the first pieces of music that I ever played in this marching band when I was 10 years old. I must have played that thing 1,000 times. I don't know. So that's one of my earliest musical memories. You know, the first time I ever played in public was in Denver, where I grew up. I played in this marching band, and we played for the stock show parade in January. It was about 10 degrees outside. I couldn't play a note because my fingers were frozen to my clarinet, and we had kind of a strict band director who insisted that we had to stay completely in a straight line. So like I said, this is a stock show, right? He said, you got to just march no matter what comes up in front of you. You can't break your stride. So anyway, I didn't play a note, but I kept my line straight and my feet got a little dirty.
Do you like marches, even though you had bad experiences sometimes in the marching band?
Well, I'm finding that I'm looking back, I'm appreciating a lot of things that I didn't at the time. I mean, playing in that marching band, it was more of a discipline thing. You know, it was like I don't think it was that much fun, or even all the years I'd spent playing the clarinet. You know, my parents said, you got to practice an hour a day, and you got to, it was like something that I had to do, where the guitar was, I sort of did that on my own. I had more fun with that.
I want to come back to that a little later, but I want to talk about this march a little bit more first. It's really fun to hear a march without any brass in it. Actually, none of these instruments, except for the clarinet and maybe the drums, are associated with marches. Certainly not the accordion, certainly not the electric guitar or bass. Did you have fun arranging this march for instruments not associated with marches?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I always had this fantasy about just taking if I could take my electric guitar and go play with just play all over the top of a marching band or something. That's sort of what it is, I guess.
There's a fun and irony on your version of this Sousa march that I'm sure you weren't encouraged to express when you were in the marching band.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. that was, like I said, I always had this urge to kind of just mess with it a little bit, or not quite destroy it, but just...
Well, get out of the regimentation.
Yeah.
My guest is guitarist Bill Frisell. He has a new album called Have a Little Faith. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is guitarist Bill Frisell. Now let me go to your version of Bob Dylan's Just Like a Woman. This isn't a song most people would think of as lending itself to an instrumental rendition. I mean, even if you don't understand what the lyrics mean, you usually think of it as a song that somebody sings.
Uh-huh.
What inspired you to arrange Just Like a Woman?
Well, Bob Dylan is another one of these just, for me, like just a giant. I guess I first heard him when I was in junior high school. I had an English teacher who used to play Bob Dylan records, and we'd talk about the lyrics and stuff, and he's really held up. And I think he's just an incredible musician. I mean, people talk about usually they talk about the words and what a great, they talk of him as a poet or... For me, he's a great, I love the way he sings, and I love the way he plays guitar. He's a great musician.
So this is another example of something that you knew earlier in your life coming back to you now.
Yeah. And one thing I love to do on the guitar is to use the guitar as a voice, or, you know, hear the words and hear his voice in my head as I'm playing the melody. I mean, I can't sing. I have enough trouble talking, let alone singing. And the guitar is sort of my way of expressing that. I just love to do that, take a song and try to sort of match what a singer would do with it.
I love the sound that you get from your guitar. There's something very spacious and very reflective, in a way, with your sound. I'm sure some of our listeners are wondering how much of your sound is from gizmos and how much of it is just from your touch.
I mean, I definitely use some gizmos, but not that much. I mean, I have a pretty simple setup. I use a volume pedal, which is really important. It sort of allows me to simulate the breath. Like all those years playing the clarinet, playing the guitar, I missed that, the ability to have the breath going into the instrument. So with a volume pedal, I can kind of simulate the up and down dynamics that you would get with your lungs, you know.
So you played clarinet for how many years before switching over to guitar?
Well, I think I was 9 or 10, however old you are when you're in fourth grade. That's when I started clarinet and played it into my second year of college. So it's that's quite a while. But fairly soon after that, I started to play the guitar. 2 or 3 years later, I saved up my money and got an electric guitar. And
this was 2 or 3 years after you started playing clarinet?
Yeah. The guitar sort of goes back even earlier than that. I remember when I was like 4 or 5 years old, and every day I would watch the Mickey Mouse Club on TV, and I couldn't wait for the part where, I think his name was Jimmy, the kind of the leader of the Mouseketeers, would come out with his guitar and sing to the kids, you know, and I really just loved looking at his guitar. And so around that time, I made my own, I cut out the shape out of a piece of cardboard and put rubber bands on it. And so that was like, I was 4 or 5 years old. I was already thinking about it a little bit.
Boy, that's great that your first influence was Jimmy from the Mouseketeers instead of Elvis. Guitar must have opened up very different social aspects of the music than the clarinet did. Because you could probably play at dances and you'd have more friends that you could be in bands with.
Right. Well, that was what made me start in the first place, was just, it was a social thing. You know, my friend across the street got a guitar, so I wanted to get a guitar. And then almost as soon as I got an electric guitar, you know, I could barely play 2 chords, but just the fact that you owned the instrument, you could play in a band.
Do you ever play very loud on stage?
Sometimes, yeah.
Is there a feeling of power when you crank up the volume with a guitar?
Yeah. it can feel real good, but then it also gets to there's a pain. There's a place where it goes from feeling good to just feeling kind of damaging too. It
But to your ears?
Yeah. I mean, I don't like to play like that loud, but I like to play at all kinds of different volume levels. But it definitely feels good to play loud. So I mean, there's with the electric guitar, there's certain things that happen with the sound that just don't happen at a lower level.
Mm-hmm. Like what? That, certain overtones?
Yeah, things start ringing and singing, and things start happening that it's harder to do at a lower level. I mean, some of the things that Jimi Hendrix did. I mean, there's ways of doing it maybe a little bit softer, but, you know, there's a lot of things just where things start to overload and...
Mm-hmm. You know, you've talked about how some of the music on this new record is music that you first heard when you were young and that you appreciate more now than you did then. I'm actually wondering if some of this music is music you wouldn't have been comfortable admitting you liked a few years ago when you were younger.
That's true. That's what I've been finding. It seems like as I get older, part of the process is being able to not be afraid to just acknowledge where I'm coming from and not worry so much about what's cool or hip or what's in fashion or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wouldn't have been that long ago that to admit that I liked Sousa March or Bob Dylan or whatever, that would have been, especially in sort of, if you're in a real jazz world, that sometimes that doesn't fit in well at all.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Guitarist Bill Frisell, his new album, Have a Little Faith, is on Elektra Nonesuch. This is his version of Madonna's Live to Tell. This is Fresh Air. The great Marian Anderson died early this morning at the age of 96. Noah Adams, will you be remembering her on All Things Considered?
You bet. We'll be talking with the opera star Todd Duncan here in Washington, D.C. He is now 90 years old himself. He met Ms. Anderson in 1932. He was present at the 1939 Easter morning Lincoln Memorial Concert. We'll hear some music from Marian Anderson and some conversation. Also, Cheryl Duvall reports from Los Angeles on efforts there to improve banking services and lending for minority communities. A church in Worcester, Massachusetts is having some trouble, scheduled to be closed, a Catholic church closed by the local diocese there, and the parishioners have decided to fight back.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Last November, ABC presented a telemovie called Willing to Kill, the Texas Cheerleader Story. It was based on the true story of Wanda Holloway, a mother who tried to secure her daughter's place on the cheerleading squad by hiring a hitman to kill a rival student and that student's mother. The plot was discovered and Holloway was stopped from committing the crime, but that didn't stop TV from getting involved twice. This Saturday, HBO presents its own version. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
HBO's telemovie is called, and this is positively true, The Positively True Adventures of the Alleged Texas Cheerleader Murdering Mom. It stars Holly Hunter as Wanda Holloway, and one of its many gimmicks is to have Holly, as Wanda, be interviewed during this telemovie. She even talks about this telemovie, and ABC's.
First, CD tried to sell his rights. Now, I couldn't sell my rights because of the Son Sam Law thing, but he could sell his, okay? Then that law got overturned, and my lawyer went with my story to ABC, CBS, NBC. They all turned it down. The reason they said was that nobody got killed and the story was considered too soft. But what I think is, maybe they were just waiting for a good deal because Terry finally sold his story to ABC for nothing, I'm sure. And that's going to end up being just another cheap movie of the week, probably put in Barbara Eden, someone like that.
The somebody for ABC was Leslie Ann Warren, who played Wanda as neurotic and high-strung. Holly Hunter plays her that way too, only at a faster speed. Here she is in a scene where Wanda is hiring her former brother-in-law Terry, played by Beau Bridges, to act as go-between and hire a killer.
Oh, God, this is so bad. I can't believe I'm sitting around talking about taking somebody's life.
Man.
God, I believe I'm going downhill, aren't I? The things you do for your kids.
Of course, Terry was wearing a police wire and the entire tape was played in court, which is why their conversation, as a matter of public record, appears so accurately in both the ABC and HBO versions. But where ABC was content to tell the story of Wanda Holloway and her murder plot, the HBO telemovie keeps going and tells the story of TV trying to tell the story. There's a scene where a reporter from A Current Affair visits the home of Verna Heath, the mother Wanda had tried to have killed. It's one of those truth is stranger than fiction scenes, showing how the reporter was outdone at his own game of manipulation.
This has taken us all so by surprise.
Is there anything that I could do for you?
Our lives interrupted.
Do you need anything?
It's Harley? Well, you know, like I said, I have all these hungry kids back there, and maybe you could get us some tacos or a burrito, some Pepsis. There's a Taco Bell just right down the way.
And then there are the rival producers trying to line up TV rights from various sources. We even see the real writer and producer of the HBO movie, who play themselves in this scene with an actor playing Wanda's ex-husband.
Terry's a loose cannon. He just sold his rights to ABC. Now they're all set to make a movie, too. Can they do that?
Well, there's money to be made. People think they can do anything.
I didn't know about this.
Oh, yeah. So is theirs going to be better than ours or what? Because their writer was talking to Patrick Gobert down at the Y, and what he told him was that ABC's was going to be real. Wasn't going to be exploitative. Nothing like that.
And they said be character-driven.
Well, never believe what a writer tells you.
Well, you can believe this. This docudrama business has gotten way out of hand. NBC already has a docudrama on the Waco compound set for May, even though David Koresh and his followers might still be in there in May. It's bad enough that multiple versions are now being made of these bizarre stories, but now TV isn't just getting into the act, it's becoming an actor. ABC's version of the Amy Fisher story did the same thing, allowing the media frenzy to be part of the story. And though that part of the HBO drama is better than the attempted murder itself, doesn't that say something? Like maybe this story wasn't so interesting in the first place? But at least the closing credits stand out. If you stay tuned that long, here's the last thing you'll hear.
Finally, no spiders or cheerleaders were killed in the making of this movie.
David Bianculli is the author of Teleliteracy, Taking Television Seriously. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In 1970, a 13-year-old girl emerged from punishing isolation imposed by her abusive father who kept her tied to a potty chair. She had no language or social skills. On the next Fresh Air, the story of Jeannie and the scientists who studied her to learn more about how humans develop language. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.